It's the Todd Ortloff Show on News Radio KONP. Now, here's Todd.
And welcome once again to the show. Kind of becomes a tradition this time of year. This is a show we always bring in a new batch of residents that are coming to town through Known. They have a rural health residency program, which we've been chatting about this for years and years now, and it really has turned into kind of beneficial. We've gotten a few docs sticking around these parts who have come through on a residency as well. So it's time to introduce three new doctors who are going to be practicing here in their next turn of things. But first, we'll talk with Michael Waters, who's from Known, who's kind of taken over this program the last couple of years. Michael, good to see you again.
Good to see you here, Todd.
So for those who know nothing about this, maybe you can give a little of the history of this.
A little of the background. So we started in 2017. Dr. Epstein, longtime community physician, got the program going. The residents spend a first year over at Swedish in Seattle, and then they come out to Port Angeles for their second and third year of training. When they're done with that, they're fully fledged family medicine physicians and go off to serve largely rural communities. We've been fortunate to have a large number of them stay in the community. Currently, five of our 14 graduates are practicing on the peninsula. Majority of those at North Olympic Healthcare Network. One of them is at Jamestown. But we're excited next year. Actually, one of our current about to graduate residents will be going to OMC. So kind of spreading the wealth out through the community.
Right. That was kind of part of the plan behind this setup as well. I know talking with Dr. Epstein so many years ago.
No, definitely.
Let's put this in place as an option. Let people get a little taste of it. You know what it's like to actually be in a community like this.
No, definitely. I mean, we're really gearing our graduates up to be able to do full spectrum rural practice if they want to. And some of them choose different routes. But we've had people go all over from Alaska to Arizona. And then obviously a goal was to hopefully bring doctors to this community. And that's definitely been panning out. We've got a new crop here.
So in bigger picture of things, I mean, it's always been a challenge to get, first of all, people to specialize in just becoming family practitioners anymore. Mm-hmm. That's challenge one. Has that changed much in the world of med students now?
It's still a struggle, actually. Yeah. I mean, the reimbursement is less. Yeah, so exactly. A lot of folks that ultimately do go in this path really have a heart for serving others in their community. We're hoping over time to realign those incentives, make it easier to make this choice. Because, I mean, honestly, there's big loan burdens. There's things that make it tough when you're looking at this job versus that. But we feel really fortunate with the residents we've had join our program.
The other part of this, too, is that typically you think about rural medicine. This is kind of one of those I'm going to have to hang my shingle and run my own practice sort of job. And that can be daunting for people to think and realizing that there now are options. You could come to an organization and practice in a rural setting, but not have to be the business savvy doctor, so to speak.
Yeah, no, there's not really these days. There's not too much of that old model. Yeah. There's sort of a newer version called the direct primary care. But no, there's definitely organizations you can join and then you don't have to run the business. You can just do the medicine part.
Right. And you get to meet up with some cool folks that are established around these parts, kind of like living here, right?
I would say so, yeah.
So what's the best part from your side of it? And then we're going to talk with these guys when you bring these folks in every year.
Yeah. So this is my job about to launch into my second year, though I've been working with the residents since 2017, 2018, but second year as program director. We get some really talented and passionate residents, and seeing them grow, especially over the second and third year here, to become ready to launch is just an exciting process. One of my recent residents I've been training to learn vasectomy, a rather difficult skill, in the clinic recently, he got called in to help with a difficult case with some of our other attending providers and was able to sort of save the day. So just seeing them grow and progress and get ready to launch out there and go really serve their communities of the future is super exciting.
Right. All right. These are folks that are right at the end of their whole training. I mean, this is being a doctor pretty much at this point.
I mean, so all these folks with us here today, they've completed medical school. They are physicians. They've already done one of their years of residency. Now they got two more to go. But no, they are physicians. It's just that final piece of training that allows them to call themselves family medicine physicians.
It's also helpful for your clinic, too. I mean, you're getting some staff that helps out. You just alluded to it. I mean, there's some folks to help out when things get to crunch time.
Yeah, we've got four physicians on our current team that went through the program. Okay. So very much so, they're helping meet our mission.
All right. You want to introduce these guys, or do you want me
to? Sure, I could introduce them. Yeah. So starting just to my right here, we've got Dr. Adam Casey, goes by Allo. And we got Dr. Alex Seuss and Dr. Sage Arvila.
All right. We're going to talk to each of them. Mm-hmm. Allo, Should I call you that? Yeah. All right. Totally. Or should I just call you Dr. Casey? Because I feel like I need to say it that way, too.
I go by all equally.
All right. Tell us a bit about you, where you're from and how you kind of got into this.
Oh, my gosh. I did a lot of moving around, but primarily from rural Oklahoma, Texas. Both sides of my family are from those areas, and I spent a lot of time growing up in those places. So, okay. But went to med school. I had a interesting med school experience. It was kind of split into two different locations. So I spent my first year in Phoenix and then my other 3 years in Brooklyn, New York.
Interesting.
Yeah.
How did that happen? I got to ask. I mean,
it's the way that geography. The program is built.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So you do one of your years there in Phoenix, and then you spend your other 3 years in another place.
Right. And yeah. You just happened to land in Brooklyn.
And that's just it. Happened.
Yeah. Very good. Rural medicine. You already talked about it. You come from a rural community, it sounds like, somewhat. So did that kind of play into your decision to, you know, maybe take this on as a final couple of years?
Definitely. Yeah. I knew kind of like from the outset, you know, of coming into medicine that's what I wanted to do was to go into rural family practice. So been thinking about this for a long time.
There is a big challenge with this though. And, you know, going into a specialty, rather than as family practitioner, I mean, there's loan burdens. I mean, there's some real life stuff you have to kind of weigh out. Take us through that part of the mental process, I guess, as you're finishing up.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I come from a family of blue collar workers, and I'm one of the first people to graduate from college, coming from my family. So, you know, kind of like the prospects for me at that time, I knew that, you know, I wanted to get out and see more of the world, but I wasn't, you know. I wasn't necessarily thinking medicine, you know, whenever I first started this journey, but it kind of came to me over time that this is something that I wanted to do.
All right, that was my next question. Did you always want to be a doctor? No.
I got my undergraduate degree in cultural and linguistic anthropology.
Now, that's a big switch.
Yeah.
So how did you get from that to going to med school?
Well, I knew, you know, when I was growing up, I was always interested in archaeology, anthropology. Those were always, you know, something I always had my head in a book. But then I got to college and I started to do those things. And while I thought it was really interesting, I knew that I wouldn't want to be in academics my whole life, specifically doing those things. Mm-hmm. So whenever I got to thinking, well, what do I want to do? Family medicine, eventually, you know, it became apparent that kind of the intersection of culture and helping people and learning more about the natural world that we live in, you know, family medicine was kind of at the intersection of all of those things.
All right. Had you ever heard of Port Angeles, Washington before this?
I had not, honestly. So I did my undergraduate training here in the Pacific Northwest, down in Portland.
Okay.
I come up to Bainbridge a couple of times to visit some folks in Seattle, and I did some guiding actually up in the North Cascades. So I used to be a wilderness guide.
But you didn't get this far west.
No.
Well, welcome. That's great. All right, let's go next to you, and that's Alex Sosus. I guess same question. How did you get started in all of this? Tell us your backstory.
Yeah, so I am from Michigan, born and raised. I did all of my schooling in Michigan. So I was from kind of the southwest part of the state next to Lake Michigan. Feels honestly kind of similar to Port Angeles, about the same size of town. We get a lot of tourism in the summer, nice lake. But I went to school at University of Michigan, did my undergrad there, did med school and a public health degree there. So I spent a lot of time in Michigan and then spent a little bit of time between college and med school, actually out in Mozambique doing Peace Corps for a couple years. So that was really my only time outside of the state. And then when it came time to applying for kind of, you know, thinking about a location, I knew I wanted Northwest. I actually wasn't thinking about Michigan in the short term, just because I think out here there's a really good reputation for training family medicine physicians who think they want to do, you know, comprehensive care, everything from deliveries to inpatient work and kind of the whole spectrum. And I had a mentor who also worked out here that spoke really highly of the area.
So you had a little bit of connection, but not a direct connection to this place.
Correct. Yeah.
Very good.
It was kind of a launching point.
So same question that I asked Adam earlier is rural medicine. You know, what made you kind of gravitate towards that?
Yeah, I grew up in a farming family. So my mom grew up on a farm. A lot of my family still kind of work in that line of work. And I feel like it's not quite as rural as maybe some of the places out here like Forks, but there's certainly the same kind of unique healthcare needs that come with growing up in a farming community and being a little bit distanced from the healthcare system. And I think selfishly, physicians who practice in rural spaces or providers who practice in rural spaces become really good providers. You learn to do a lot of it without specialists and kind of provide a little bit more access to folks who really need it.
Take us through med school, though. Is there a real pressure to specialize, or at least you feel there's a pressure to do that?
I would say, especially if you go to a school that's academic in nature, there's a lot of I know the school that I went to had recently put, you know, a family medicine provider kind of on the board and in leadership. But before that year, there really hadn't been as many primary care providers. So there's a lot of either overt pressure or kind of peer pressure that kind of comes with growing or, you know, spending your training in a pretty academic space.
Have you always wanted to be a doctor? Is that always a career path for you?
I thought about it for a long time. Part of it, I think, because my last name's Seuss, and so Dr. Seuss. I really liked, you know, similar to Aloe, I think the cross between culture, relationships, kind of getting to know your community, and, you know, for somebody who wants to keep learning and is curious about a lot of different things, medicine's really fun.
All right. Well, welcome to the community. You got a couple of years to kick it around here for a while, so that'll be great. All right, let's talk to Sage. Sage Arvilla, is that right? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about you, your backstory. How'd you get to this?
Yeah, I actually grew up out here on the peninsula, so I grew up in Forks. My family moved when I was in late middle school, early high school, into Kitsap County, and now my family's scattered around the Kitsap Peninsula, but I have a direct connection out here, and I loved growing up here, and so that's what brought me back out here. I graduated from high school in Kitsap County, and then I went up to Western Washington University in Bellingham. Took a short jaunt over to Boston for medical school and then came back for residency. So I'm super excited to be back out here and even more excited to be out of the city.
Not a big city girl.
Not a big city girl. Any city, happy to be gone.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
I think this is the first time I've talked to someone who's directly had a link that closely, I think.
I think our second class had somebody from Port Angeles, Kristen Poole, who actually now works at Jamestown.
Right. That's right.
But other than that, I think you might be our second.
Yeah, so that's pretty exciting. So when the opportunity kind of bubbled up, you said, absolutely, I'm going to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, there's no guarantee when you applied that this was going to work out, so it was a very pleasant surprise this has happened for you.
Yeah, no, I was very happy when I found out I matched out here.
Right, very good.
Because I was definitely hoping to come back. So,
did you always want to be a doctor?
I did not. I started out in undergrad thinking about teaching, and I was in a teaching program, and then I kind of transitioned when I got to student teaching away from teaching because I found that I really wanted to continue learning myself. And I still really love to teach, but I feel like there's a lot of opportunities for teaching within medicine, and so the combination of lifelong learning and also getting to be a teacher to my patients, to my colleagues, to medical students, all of those things really drew me in towards medicine.
All right, you're all the way back in Boston. I'll ask the same question. Was there pressure to not go into, you know, rural general practitioner work?
Yeah, I think that my school had a great family medicine department, and the folks in the family medicine department were very supportive of me going into family medicine. I feel like the school overall was less supportive of family medicine, and we did not get as many folks from Boston who went into family medicine. The culture is very different on the East Coast, and there were only two students in my class who actually chose to go into family medicine out of about 160 of us. But I do feel like there were mentors around who were actively encouraging to those of us who did want to.
All right. So I guess you become the default tour guide for these other two that are in here, right? You get to tell them where to go and all of that stuff.
It's been a while, so I feel like I'm discovering a lot of new things out here myself. But
Well, welcome back. Welcome back home as well. I should have asked this earlier. Maybe you can, Sage, tell us a bit about the application process. You have to put in for this thing. And there's some interviews and some things that happen. It's not just a set, you're in.
Yeah, residents go through a process called the match in their last year of medical school. And so basically we apply to a ton of different programs in the specialty that we're interested in. And then the programs review our applications and decide if they want to interview us. You then go through like a process of interviewing, and then when like at the end of the day, what happens is you make a list of your favorites in order, and then the programs make a list of their favorite applicants in order, and some computer somewhere runs an equation and decides where we go.
And yours matched back home.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to ask each of these, but Sage is already here. What do you do when you're not being a doctor? What do you like doing in your free time?
I love to sail. And so I am looking to get involved in the sailing community out here. I like water sports in general, like paddleboarding, kayaking.
Okay.
And then I have a dog and two cats who I enjoy spending lots of time with. Yeah.
And so far, describe the, because you guys have been on the ground running here, this isn't like your first day on the job, right? Mm-hmm. So what have you been doing since you've came to town?
Yeah, we've have a month to kind of get used to the community, settle into the community. And so we've been meeting with local community organizations, learning about the resources that are available out here on the peninsula before we start seeing patients ourselves. And then we've been kind of starting to integrate into clinic, and we've also had a lot of free time to get to know the area, go on hikes. Alex and I went paddle boarding this last weekend at Lake Crescent, so we've had time to really get to know the community and what's out here.
All right. Well, I guess that's part of what Alex, my question is, what do you do when you're not being a doctor? Paddle boarding with your friends, I guess, is part of it, but what do you like to do outside?
Yeah, that was my first paddleboard experience, and it was the best choice I've made so far coming out here, other than being out here. But being out in nature, you know, hiking, swimming, running, paddleboarding. I do some things that are less outdoorsy. I like knitting a lot. I discovered the knitting circle around you already. Reading. And then trying to find community. Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of different opportunities out here that I've been impressed by. Either, you know, live music or running club or the library is really great. There's just a lot of opportunities we're exploring this month.
All right. Knitting is a popular thing. There's knitting that comes up, Michael, almost every time when I talk with
a lot of our residents have been very into knitting.
Crochet,
and I like education
stuff, yeah.
Education days, there's usually somebody working on something. It's great.
I don't know. I get it. It's a great mental purger in some ways. You can kind of really clear your head. I understand that. All right. Let's go over to Adam and a bit about you. What do you do when you're not doing this doctor thing? What do you like to do?
Well, right now it's moving into my new place. So, but I love to spend a lot of time outdoors. So that's where I like to, you know, go out, spend time, especially getting to know the landscape. I feel like just because a lot of this training journey has, you know, required that I be in a lot more urban areas. Finally kind of coming back to a place, you know, where I can get outside and, you know, get to know the mountains and, you know, all the things that live there, you know, I'm actually really excited about. So.
All right. Sounds like all three of you are glad to be out of the city and out doing this part of your medical training. So welcome all three of you here. And we hope you enjoy the next couple of years here, and maybe, well, you'll stick around too. If, who knows when things are all said and done. Michael, they take us kind of through what happens with this core. You've got kind of different levels of people. We have the group we talked with last year at this time.
Yeah.
They're a year ahead.
They are. Yeah. So this current cohort, they finished their first year in Seattle. Or just kind of finishing the final block of that. So then they'll have their second year, which is a fair bit of inpatient work over at OMC, delivering babies, seeing people in medicine wards, ICU, along with a lot of clinic. There's not as much flexibility. And then the third year is really a time to sort of craft looking at what will their future jobs be. There's a lot more elective time, we call it, where they can decide whether that's here locally or going somewhere else to gain experiences to prepare them for that future job they're going to be taking, and some time to interview and start looking for those. So kind of two more years here, intense inpatient, and then a little more flexibility as they complete their training.
All right. Well, welcome again. Great to have that. I always love this show because I get to meet some really cool people that have decided to come this way. Michael, it's great to talk to you as well. Thanks for stopping by. I'm bringing them along.
Thanks so much for having us,
Michael
Todd.
Waters there from Known. Also, we have Adam Allo Casey here. Dr. Casey. Dr. Seuss. I didn't even catch that. I need to tell folks, so it's Soos. It's not like the actual author. Yeah, right. And Sage Arvilla, thanks for coming in today, and good luck, you guys. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with more on our show right after this.
This is the Todd Ortloff Show on News Radio KONP. Have you ever clicked get a quote online and suddenly your phone acts like it owes someone money? 20 calls a day, numbers you've never seen, and not one of them local? I'm Dan Shappy with Farmers Insurance. If you're tired of mystery callers trying to sell you insurance, try something different. Talk directly to a real local agent who actually lives here. No robocalls, no strangers. We are real people helping real people right here at home.
We are Farmers. Bum, ba, dum,
bum, 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 bum. Underwritten by Farmers, Truck Fire Insurance, Exchanges, and Affiliates. Products not available in every state.
And welcome back to the program. Going to spend some time talking about, really an interesting program you can still get tickets for at Field Arts and Events Hall. It's a combination of culinary and artistry put together, and it's called Based on the School of Essential Ingredients. That is the beloved novel for my guest, Erica Bauermeister, who is going to be leading this, talking about that book, and we're going to talk with her a little bit about how she came up with it as well. Erica, I appreciate you spending some time with our listeners today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to just roll back because tell me the story of how you put this book together, because if I understand this correctly, this wasn't something you set out necessarily to do in life, right?
I always wanted to be a writer, but I always thought I would need to write nonfiction,
right?
Because I didn't know how to come up with fictional characters. I mean, it just wasn't anything that made sense to me. And then we actually lived in Italy for a couple of years. I got into cooking in an entirely different way, very non-recipe-based cooking. We moved back to the States in 99. And it wasn't, you know, food wasn't as big of a thing then. Mm-hmm. And so I took a cooking class, and we killed crabs with our bare hands. And not what I was expecting to be doing, and especially not what I expected to be doing in a room of strangers, you know. And it was this visceral, intimate act. And I thought, suddenly this idea just hit me. It's like, well, what if you put 8 people in a cooking class, all of them strangers, and you had them keep doing this intimate activity of touching each other's food, basically, you know, like what kind of relationships would form and who would, you know, what would be the food that each person would need to take them to the next place in their life? Mm-hmm. And it was like building a house with empty rooms, and the characters just started moving in. They're not anybody I've ever met before.
Okay.
And it was this miraculous experience, and it was all because of food. So
you beat me to my next question. I was going to say, well, this had to have been based on somebody you knew, but none of these are out of whole cloth, all your characters, basically.
Absolutely. And I got to tell you, it's the first question I always get asked, is are they based on people you know? Yeah. And I think because people feel like I must know them, but I don't. I really don't.
Well, I think because they're very intimate in the book. I mean, you can't just make that stuff up, but I guess you can.
yes, I think you can, you know.
Have you always been a cooking fan, though? I mean, has that been something that has been part of what, you know, drove you besides wanting to be a writer?
You know, I was always curious about it, but I grew up in a very recipe-based household,
yeah, okay.
And it was like cooking was one more thing to do wrong. You know, if you follow a recipe, you can do it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be wrong, and so it wasn't until we moved to Italy, and I still remember this one time I went to the little neighborhood, you know, vegetable guy, and I said, okay, I want to make minestrone soup, and what do I need to put in it? And he just looked at me and he smiled. People were very nice. They kind of treated us like puppies, you know.
Yeah.
We didn't know much, but we were very enthusiastic. And he looked at me and he just opened his arms and said, whatever you want. And I just thought, what?
What?
I can
now
do
what?
Anything I want in my soup? That's crazy. But it was so much fun.
Yeah.
It was like poetry, you know, like this was poetry with food. And it made sense to me. So,
did you surprise yourself when you had the freedom of, you know, get off the recipe, so to speak?
Yes, absolutely. Because you start listening, you know, you start listening to the sounds of what it makes in the pan, or smelling, like, okay, those cookies smell done. I'm not going to wait for the timer and then take them out burned. They smell done now. I'm going to go check them, you know, or I'm going to taste this sauce and I'm going to decide what else it needs more of. And that is what herbs play well with what other herbs, you know.
Yeah.
And you develop this vocabulary and yeah, you're playing. It's fun.
All right, so you write this novel. The next thing must have been a surprise. All of a sudden it's a New York Times bestseller. Did you ever think that would happen?
No, I didn't. I never thought. I remember, like, I had tried to get published for almost 20 years. I had written 3 different memoirs. The irony being everybody said that they weren't personal enough, and as soon as I wrote fiction, everybody said my fiction was so personal. So, you know, I had been trying and trying, rejected hundreds of times. And then I write this novel, which I never anticipated would be published, sent it to an agent. Agent picked it up, and I mean, she sold it immediately. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I'd won the lottery. It just, that's what it felt like. And I think any aspiring author out there would tell you the same thing. You know, it is, and your chances of succeeding is probably right up there with the lottery, yeah. Quite honestly. Yeah.
The book's unique. I mean, let's just face it. What you've came up with is very unique, and that probably helped a lot with this. But what was the reaction to people when they first read this? When you first put this together, you got it out. The agent's shopping it. As you mentioned, it caught on quickly. But what was some surprise reaction that people had to it?
You know, what was interesting to me and what led to a later book of mine about how everybody reads a book differently is how differently people responded. Yeah. I mean, I got letters from, you know, widowers who said, you helped me get past my grief. And I had, you know, Kirkus Review hated it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's just like, it really, you realize when you write something that's personal, that strikes people's hearts and souls, that they will react based on who and where they are at that point in their life. And so if what you said speaks to what they need to hear, they're going to love it. And, you know, yes, your talent matters. Yes, your wordsmithing matters. But it also matters what you're talking about. And I think that's part of why this book, which is 17 years old, is having a resurgence right now, because I think we need that kind of compassion in the world. There isn't enough of it. There's not enough kindness. There's not enough empathy. And I think a book like this that encourages that makes people feel seen and comfortable. And we want that.
Yeah, I can tell you, we need anything that gets us off of a social media feed. I think that's a good thing in these days, because we're just so intense on those spots as well. Do you have that loaded question? Do you have a favorite character or a favorite story throughout this that just for you resonates maybe more than any other?
You know, here's the thing: when the characters started coming to me, I was so shocked and so grateful that I made this deal. Which is, I would never write a character I couldn't love.
Okay.
I didn't have to like them, but I had to have enough compassion to love them and understand who they were as human beings. So as a result, I love all of these characters. Yeah. And that said, there are 2 characters. There's Isabel, who has Alzheimer's, who is just kind of a love in my life. I thought she'd be this sweet little white-haired grandmother, and she ended up having this crazy past, and she had so much life in her that I just adored her. And you know, when these characters come to me, I have no idea where they're going to go. You know, I kind of say, okay, you have to go to the cooking class. Some food has to affect you in order for you to be in my book, but the story's yours. So take it and run. And they do. And then the other one is Tom, who is the widower. And I just, that was the first story I finished. It's in the middle of the book, and it was the first story I finished. And I just was so grateful that he helped me get to that point and to be able to explore grief in the way that he does. And his story gets a lot of reactions, I have to say.
I get that. Okay, so on the 23rd, you're going to be up at Field Hall and doing kind of a really unique thing in that you're going to do some readings, and this is paired with some culinary delights as well and some wines, too. Tell us kind of about this whole thing. Is this something you've done before?
No, yeah. Honestly. I mean, I had a bookstore turn their whole bookstore into a restaurant, did 3-course dinner. That was amazing. But no, this was Steve Rader Ginsburg's idea, and he contacted me and he said, I want to do a dinner and I want to make the food be out of the book. We've got a great chef in Jeff Andrews, and we want to have him make up the menu, and he's done a fabulous job, and he read the book and he resonated with the book, and he's come up with this beautiful 4 courses. It involves crab and pasta bolognese and this amazing cake, and it's just going to be incredible. And then Marrowstone Winery is pairing the wines, and I'm a longtime fan of theirs. And then in between each course, we're going to take a break, as you should, between courses. You know, we're going to stall this out like a good Italian dinner and tell stories and do readings and have people meet each other. And so I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great.
In a lot of ways, this is going to go full circle or back to the getting everybody together in this cooking class, more or less. Although you're not doing a class, but you're being sharing the food at least, right?
Yeah, and it has that very Italian feel of let's take it slow, right? Yeah. Let's not gobble down everything in 15 minutes. Let's make an evening out of it and create a community.
We should point out that all of these courses have, you know, they're attached to a character. You got Claire's roasted crab. You've got Tom's pasta sauce is going to be part of this, right? As we talked about Tom.
Yep.
And Carl's white cake as well. I'm just throwing that out there for folks that may want to take this up. And tickets are still available. You can get a few. I think there's a few left to do this as well. And what a nice chance to be kind of having an intimate, you're going to be right there with us. So that's, it's not like you're at this big lecture hall and there's Erica talking at the front of it.
No, but I'm so excited to do it at Field Hall because that's such a beautiful, beautiful venue, you know, with the view and the whole space. It just has a wonderful feel to it. So I think it's the perfect location for it.
Well, we are excited to have you come up this way and do this thing. I think, Steve Rader Ginsburg has kind of unique genius ideas about stuff once in a while. Be careful. This will become a regular thing for you. I don't know if that's all right with you or not, but I think we probably could handle you coming up more than once.
Well, you know, I have six novels, so, you know.
We've got six shots. We get six shots at this. All right. Erica, we'll see you up here next week, and let folks know, go to Field Hall, Field Events website, and they've got some tickets there. You can just click on the lovely picture on the front of you there as well for the School of Essential Ingredients, and do pick up the novel and read it because it's pretty it's a good book, just even if you're not going to eat the meal with it. Erica, great talking with you.
Thanks, Todd. I appreciate it.
All right, that's Erica Bauermeister there, who is the author of the School of Essential Ingredients. And yes, do come and get tickets if you can on the 23rd. It's a really unique experience at Field Hall. We're going to take a break. Be back with more in just a moment.
This is the Todd Ortloff Show on News Radio KONP.
Hi, it's Dan Shappy with Farmers Insurance. Community matters, and that's why we're proud to support Todd Ortloff and local voices that keep us connected. If you want insurance advice from real neighbors, stop by our office on Peabody Street. Real people helping real people right here at home.
Dan Shappy and Farmers Insurance is proud to sponsor the Todd Ortloff Show every Monday through Thursday at 1 p.m.
We are farmers. Bum, ba-dum, bum, 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 bum.
Underwritten by Farmers, Truck Fire Insurance, Exchanges, and Affiliates. Products not available in every state.
Welcome back to our last segment here. Going to spend a few minutes talking with Sheldon Kohler, who's with the local hams, the amateur radio club here locally. And they, every year, put on what's called Field Day, and it's actually part of an international event, and it's coming up on June 27th for the public to get involved with, and I'm assuming out at the fairgrounds again this year?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, we're in the field where the carnival is usually held in August.
So. All right. So tell us a bit about Field Day, first of all, and how, you know, what this is all about.
Primary function is to test our equipment in an off-grid scenario. We go out to the field and we set up antennas and solar panels and generators and batteries and as well as the radios, of course, and test things out. It's an educational because as we're assembling and putting things together, new hams are learning and getting hands-on on doing stuff like this. And prospective hams, people that want to learn or know about what we do, can see what's going on.
And we've talked in years past, that's part of the public part of this. I mean, you want folks to come out and actually see some of this.
Yes.
Maybe the bug might bite you while you're out there.
That's correct. Come out on Saturday afternoon from 12 to 4, and there are radios you can actually try out. You don't need to be licensed because we have people on site that are known as what are called control operators. Since they're licensed, they can make sure you're not breaking any laws, and it's fun to do.
I know in years past you've had folks that go out, they get online on the air, and they're talking to people around the world, and they're just absolutely
amazed. And
yes.
It's like, wow, I'm doing this from Port Angeles at the fairgrounds.
Yes, and the internet's not involved.
That's also true, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And this is a big part of this is that it's just that. I mean, what right. you guys are kind of, you task yourself, the county actually has you written into its emergency management plans as ways to help in the event of a catastrophic emergency around here. You guys are going to help us communicate.
As Hawaii and Florida found out that when they have a huge natural disaster, the cell towers are down.
That's right.
And some of the hurricanes down southeast, they've actually been completely destroyed, and it's been weeks. And forget which island it was, but I knew somebody who actually flew down with ham radio equipment because it was months for them mm-hmm. to get their infrastructure back up. And they spent months relaying messages by ham radio before their infrastructure was to a functional point for emergency use.
All right. And I think in this world that we're kind of all becoming a little bit more preppers and stuff like that, I have a little more appreciation, I guess, for what amateur radio is doing as well. It's I think it's going to be a vital link to us at some point.
Well, we prepare for it. You know, it's.
You hope you never have to do it.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. You prepare for the worst and hope for the best, they say.
So you have been a ham how long?
Over 30 years.
Yeah. So how did you get started? What was your entry?
Well, my entry was actually goes back even further, decades further. Ironically, I have a rare form of dyslexia and didn't know it for decades. I was in my 40s when I found out. So I have no rhythm. I've never been able to play a musical instrument. Mm-hmm. At 10 years old, the piano instructor scribbled across my homework and threw it at me and said, he can't count. I can still hear his German accent. He can't count. And he's right. I can't. And it prevented me from learning Morse code. I actually tried taking the test at the age of 12.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't. I can't hear it.
Yeah, because and it's a rhythm. It's all, dots and dashes.
Exactly. Right? I mean, you know, my wife, who's a musician, I've been trying to get her for years. She just is afraid of the minor math, which isn't hard, but she's just doesn't like tests, so I can't get her to do it. She was fascinated by Morse code, and she actually not really a white elephant, but a gift exchange at the club we had one Christmas a few years back. She was given an antique Morse code key. She won't get rid of it.
Well, it's kind of cool. I mean,
it is. It's in the. It has the original
she's
brown.
She's ditting and dotting all over the place.
No, then. She's not. It's still in the box, but it came with the original box and paperwork. So it's a collector's piece.
Now, that's one part of things as well. Morse code's not required now.
No, that's as soon as that law lifted in 1992, I took the test.
And that's what Otherwise, you would have been in this a lot sooner than
decades,
that.
Decades,
However, we've talked in the past, and knowing Morse code or having, you know, being around it or able to somewhat decipher it is still a good thing because that might be the only way some communication gets through.
That's true to a point. As becoming less true. Certain digital functions now are coming out. There is a function called FT8. And using a computer that's digitally hooked up to your radio and using SDR or software-defined radio and DSP, digital signal mm-hmm. processing, they can pull stuff out of the noise that the human ear can't hear.
Interesting. Okay. So over all that static.
So over all the static, the computer can pull out something useful. And that's a fun. I'm not involved with that, but there are quite a few people here locally that are.
Right. You know, the technology, too. I mean, it's just amazing. You don't have to have... I know you have a big ham shack. I mean, that's just what you do when you get into this thing. But you can get on the air with just a small handheld radio and do a lot of stuff.
Most new hams, they start off with a handheld.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just an HT for handy talkie, which goes back to the early years of the old World War I, World War II. Which were actually more than just handheld, but they still called them handy talkies.
How much can I do with, you know, that in an entry level? Who can I talk to on a handy talkie right now?
Depending on propagation and terrain, mm-hmm. VHF and UHF frequencies are somewhat line of sight, and that's what most handhelds are. So, up islands, I've actually talked without the use of what's called a repeater, up to Vancouver, Canada.
Not bad.
So from bad. From a handheld, they're definitely over in the northern mainland, Bellingham area, the islands, and up Vancouver. As a matter of fact, swinging around to the repeaters, we have repeaters on the Olympic Peninsula. The Victoria Ham Club has theirs on Salt Spring Island and a few others around the island. And they like to use our repeaters as well as we like to use theirs because they kind of work across the water very well with each other.
And with the repeaters, then you're kind of like getting everywhere.
Yes,
right.
You can. Yeah. It definitely greatly increases your range because you're hitting for our most popular one around here is the one on Striped Peak. From a handheld, you hit Striped Peak, and then Striped Peak can go out west without too much issue. And as well as we have what we call an internet link. So with that, you can punch in a code number to a location somewhere else on the planet to another repeater that's so equipped. And then from radio to radio, you can talk to another ham. The furthest I've done that, the IRLP, there's also EchoLink. Those are the two big ones. Using that mode, I've actually talked to somebody at McMurdo Station in Antarctica that way.
Oh, wow. That's great.
So that was fun. And the reason I remember that is because his grandmother lived in Squim.
Get out. Honestly, it's a small world, isn't it?
It is. It is.
And you really realize that.
It's a lot of fun.
Well, and of course, you then evolve into getting different, you know, going on different frequencies and that sort of thing as well. That's part of the hobby here.
There's many different aspects. We mentioned Morse code earlier, or CW for continuous wave. It is more popular now than it was when it was a requirement.
Yeah.
So now that it's not a requirement, people are fascinated with it.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's something I can do if I want to do it.
Yes.
Not that I have to do it.
Correct.
Very good. Okay, back to the field day. For folks to stop out, give us kind of the hours on that Saturday. That's a week from this Saturday.
It's a week from this Saturday, the 27th, from 12 to 4. Okay. Saturday afternoon, there will be people there showing off. You mentioned the County Emergency Management. Their trailer will be out there, the ARES group, Amateur Radio Emergency Services, A-R-E-S. They will have it manned and operational, so you can see that in use. And we are attempting to build a big antenna. I'm not sure if we're going to get it done. What's called a long wire that's going to be strung from the trees above everybody's heads. So we'll see if we get that up or not.
Now, if you get that up, what is that going to let you do?
It will definitely greatly increase range. We have actually on some field days when the solar system was correct and the propagation was good, we've hit Japan and South America, as well as Northern Europe.
All right.
So it all depends on what the solar cycle's like.
Exactly. I guess we'll have to check that a little closer to see if it's a good day or not on that Saturday. It's fascinating, and it's great to. I always, if you got kids, bring them out too, because
definitely bring the kids. The kids have fun.
Yeah.
When you hand them a microphone and they talk to somebody and find out where they are, their eyes get big.
Absolutely. All right. Not this Saturday, a week from out at the fairgrounds. It's a good time. You guys are a great group of folks that put this on.
Too, thank you. So. It's a lot of fun. We've been doing it since the 50s.
Yeah. And not a day over what?
Well, I haven't been doing it since the 50s, but the local club.
Sheldon Kohler, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right.
It.
Sheldon's with the local ham operators, and field day is coming up out at the fairgrounds on June 27th in the afternoon. Stop on out and check it out if you can. We're going to wrap things up, check in with the news next.